The title of the talk today is Dawn, Day, Dusk, Dark. It keeps coming to my mind in the last month or so since I heard about a discovery of one of our ancestors' bones. And how that skeleton can help us think differently about its descendants, us. How we can think differently about maybe why we have this big head. Because our thinking is so often our problem and other people's problem also. It's easy to have a grudge against our brain and to think badly of it. And the shape of the pelvis of the skeleton of one of our ancestors and the shape of the hand of that skeleton surprised scientists, and it changed some of the ideas about what this big head might be for. And instead of going into details that I don't really know very well, the scientific part, if we can just take that as like a springboard for being more open about our own being human, and especially the brain. They used to say, I don't know if they're still saying that, but they used to say that we only use a really small percentage of our capacity up here. And that could also help us think differently about what it might be for, what its potential might be. It seems like our idea about the human being is that we're that one step beyond the animal because we can think. And then we get divided in ourselves and amongst ourselves because we see how our thinking makes us act much more stupidly and aggressively than animals do. And so we have this dual inheritance where we think that thinking is something that makes us that step ahead of the other creatures. And we also notice that thinking is not helping very much. And so if we're not using much of what we have, and the way that we're using it so far is not very helpful, I'd like to point out the possibility of a kind of continuum in our experience, that when we're careless with our brains and we let it think according to its training, which is to go be scattered around and to worry, and to try to plan. If we notice that happening, to notice what are the results, like did it work out well or not? And then when that's not happening, what's more available? As if it's like the same material when it's misused, activated in scattered mind, and when it's not being misused, what's more available, which it might not be like a simple continuum of like a seesaw, anxiety, and then some one other thing. It might be like the river meets the sea. More options than one. But in one of my, we could say lineages, they talk about the energy that can come as anxiety and obsessive thinking, and the statement in the mind, I hate when someone, da, 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 or I hate broccoli, or whatever. So that is one expression of an energy that when it's more freed, is called Transcending the Five Senses. And it's also called Transcending Fear. So this talk is partly continuation from yesterday, where there's the idea to feel what really is deep rest, and how deep rest has something to do with no fear, no separation. And so you may have noticed that most of the time the thinking is, let's be kind and polite and say unhelpful. And occasionally there is a thought that's kind of real, you could say. Occasionally there is even a plan, an idea that comes to mind about what I could do later on. And it has a totally different authentic feeling to it. So that's one thing to feel for, to be aware of how that is in your experience. Another way to play with this is when you notice a sense of carrying burden, of being heavy laden, having heaviness of any kind. The possibility of that sense of heaviness being a signal, saying, use your whole brain, not just that little part you're used to using, that you got trained to use. And be open to the parts that you got trained not to use. And what if you either actually feel, be in contact with the sense of heaviness? Which I find when I do that, it's not heavy anymore in that same way. Or sometimes we could drop the weight. And when it's the weight of the world, showing in whatever way, emotionally or mentally or physically or spiritually, psychologically, feeling how me carrying the weight of the world, like feeling guilty that I'm here when there's all that I should be doing out there and all those people who can't be here, all of that. To feel how that me carrying the weight of the world is a manner of separation from the world. And maybe in the big brain, we are the world. And maybe there is not that gap that we imagine. And maybe in our big brain, there are many helpful ways of having perspective on us and on what is. What is that's visible and what is that's invisible. And four of those kind of, the word genre comes to mind, four of those maybe wavelengths of our new brain, still pretty new on the planet. So it's okay that we got caught off guard and we got used to only using one part. It'd be like being at the front door and just playing with the doorknob over and over again. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And so that's the title of the talk, Dawn, Day, Dusk, Dark. So we could say the mood of dawn, or the mode of dawn, is where sometimes it happens to us that it feels as if it's the first time of an out-breath or a pond or a cricket. And it's happening to us is the best blessing. And we can also go there. And it's like with dawn, if we would kind of tread to, in a daytime way, we would break dawn. We would lose that freshness. Sometimes we could play and kind of bring it on. And it's not quite the same as when it happens, and that's also good. Both are good. But the practice, the possibility of practicing dawn, practicing freshness, practicing being born, practicing as if for the first time, while looking at something, hearing something, touching something, or not particularly in touch with anything, but in touch with no thing. Because dawn and here, I recommend being outside at these different times of day. So dawn is often a misty time from the pond. And it can help us appreciate the misty mind in a world where we think the mind is supposed to be only very sharp, clever, quick, kind of crystalline. And so I brought my friend again, Khalil Gibran, and he says, life and all that lives is conceived in the mist and not in the crystal. And we'll get to crystalline when it's daytime and nighttime. But the importance of misty, the importance of not yet formed or just formed, and then therefore it's okay to be surprised and not know what I'm supposed to do, that we're allowed to be unprepared for what just happened. So that innocence. And it's an innocence that could be fascinated by the doorknob and could equally be accidentally opening the door and breaking the rules and accidentally going inside somewhere that hasn't been gone before. I've noticed that when I wake up early in the morning, I like to absorb that light that is then and not turn on any other light, except maybe a candle. And so when it's that kind of mood in your experience where it's misty and unformed or just formed, and you know you don't know, and appreciation is not far away, and terror also, but maybe more often at dawn there's a sense with the freshness. And the innocence. That there's somehow a way, by not knowing all of those dangers that clearly, I could walk without worry. Or stay still without worry. And another line that continues in this book, The Prophet, a little bit later, where he said, the Prophet in the book and Khalil Gibran say, don't we know that that which seems weakest, that seems the most feeble in us, is strongest and most determined? And he gives another example where the breath he says, isn't it the breath that builds your bones? So leaving room for that mode of dawn, so that the day can be built out of it, so that crystalline can come and really be clear. Are there any questions or comments?
As you're saying, misty thinking, what I experience is fuzzy thinking, mm-hmm. often, or like garbled.
Yes. That's one example. Yes.
I mean, that would be
an example.
That I just be okay with that. Mm-hmm.
Not beating yourself up about it sounds like a good idea. Yeah.
Very freeing to hear that.
Yeah.
And to be okay with not being okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which I have kind of come to that place of thinking, well, maybe I should be okay with this not knowing and just fumbling and bumbling and
yeah.
which always seems to be doing. So.
Yeah. When you go into the room, and you don't know where things are, and it might be a little darker, we fumble and we bumble. And if we can feel that there could be freshness in it.
We give ourselves time to maybe adjust to the light.
And meanwhile, adjusting happens. Yeah. Which is refinement in our big brain.
A little more about that which is feeble is what makes us more strong or is the strongest. I mean, why isn't the thing that's already very strong, why isn't that just as strong as?
Mm-hmm. I think what he's pointing to is maybe one way to look at it is we're so used to bodies, and this is, okay, this is me and that's you and now what? As if this is the starting place. And not leaving an openness to the mystery of how this came to be and how it also then continues to be. And so it's something that can bring a body out of nearly nothing. Without necessarily making it into a something that does it, but it is a mystery that we tend to ignore because it's too misty, because we can't get it this way. I really think we cannot get it this way. So. And we can be open to that mystery of how something seems to come out of nowhere, like a thought seems to come out of nowhere. So all day, like not only when we're, we can be open to birth and mystery of that. And open to not pin it down, but still that we could clearly experience it in that misty way, very fresh and wordless. And that already gives us another experience of thought, for example. And then what about the experience of silence? Again, somehow that happens. It comes out of nowhere. Or an experience of peace. We can feel it. It's not necessarily located exactly, but it does come sometimes, and it seems to come out of nowhere. Any other? So far? So day. think day might be our hardest to enter, like to get across the shiny surface. Maybe because for me, what I mean by day is when we start to go into action and we easily get carried away. And so how I like to think about day as a skill and a knowing and another perspective that might be available and might be more available with practice. I like to think about, for example, in our doing with a sense of the simpleness, but also the importance of what we do, how what we do can stay around longer than my body. In very obvious ways, so like sometimes if you could come across, it's not as easy to find in this country as in Europe, something that was built, an actual building that was built to last longer than your body. And just the feeling of being near that building, which is to be near an action of a person or some people whose bodies are not active. And it gives a kind of quietness to our doing. Because sometimes there is doing that needs to be done fast. Sometimes. And often if we, like, if we would really look at our list of things to do with the feeling of the building that has lasted, there would be probably more than half the things on the list that we know we don't need to do. We need to not do them. And to get the pen out, if it's not in your device, I try to imagine what that's like. Get your pen out and actually cross those things off your list and let that be like really crossed off in your body and in your being. So that there is some time to do what you can do, and to do it well. And there is actually something beautiful in this book about that, so if you will indulge me, may I? So one part, and this is continuing in what I read yesterday about work. The prophet is telling the people who asked and who are about to say goodbye to this prophet, who knows them better than they know themselves. He says, "You've been told also that life is darkness. And in your weariness and your tiredness, you echo what was said by the weary." So we might change the words a little bit now and say, we've heard that life is busyness, and in our exhaustion, we echo what was said by the exhausted. Or in our busyness, we echo what was said by the busy. And I say that life is indeed darkness, save when there is urge, and all urge is blind, save when there is knowledge. And all knowledge is vain, save when there is work, and all work is empty, save when there is love. And when you work with love, this is getting me. I never got over the pregnancy hormones. This never used to happen to me. And when you work with love, you bind yourself to yourself and to one another and to God. And maybe I'll post as a kind of dessert, the part about what is it to work with love. And he says, work is love made visible. And if you cannot work with love, but only with distaste, we could actually say, if you cannot live with love, but only with distaste, with bitterness, it is better that you should leave your work and sit at the gate of the temple and take alms of those who work with joy. For if you bake bread with indifference, you bake a bitter bread that feeds but half of our hunger. And if you sing, though as angels, and love not the singing, you muffle our ears to the voices of the day and the voices of the night. This book, speaking of this doing things to last, it was, he says that it, the prophet, Gibran, says that it was in him, I don't think he says how many years, but many, many years from back when he was still in Lebanon. He says, I think I've never been without the prophet since I first conceived the book back in Mount Lebanon. It seems to have been part of me. I kept the manuscript 4 years before I delivered it over to my publisher because I wanted to be sure. I wanted to be very sure that every word of it was the very best I had to offer. When did it publish? 1923. Almost 100 years ago. Another way of thinking about knowing that what we do lasts longer than we do. Sometimes to think of our life as a journey, and this is easy for anyone who's traveled in India on a train, especially if you were like not in the air-conditioned part, but the regular part, for a while at least. Because you have your ticket, and so does everybody else, usually. And then you have your sometimes 48 hours in a room without doors with those people that have the ticket next to you. And you eat and sleep and live together with whoever they are. And how is the journey going to be? And you know that there sometimes are the child that's going to vomit on your shoes and the mother who's not going to clean it up, because it's your shoes and they don't touch shoes. And even if you say, well, I don't do vomit, you may or may not get a response. And they're going to be the ones that stay up late drinking and playing cards while you're trying to sleep, even though it says on the wall, like, silence after 10 o'clock. How is your journey going to be? And sometimes the tea person comes when you want it to come. And when you're counting on it to come, it doesn't come. The train gets stopped one time. We were all ready for our morning tea. And the train got stuck because a tree had fallen across the tracks, a big Bodhi tree. And there was a beehive in the tree that had gotten disturbed in the falling of the tree. And there were many people trying to move the tree, but they had to take care of the bees first. So it took about 6 hours to get our morning tea. And how is the journey going to be? So if we get too much into using our brains the way we use our brains now, we would easily start to take things as signs in a simplistic kind of way. What do the bees mean? The Bodhi tree blocking the tracks. And the bees. And the people helping. What does it mean? about me and about the decisions I made getting on this train. So the possibility of knowing that people are going to be different, almost predictably so. And that we don't have to agree. But the journey is much more enjoyable when we can feel, yeah, like the nectar of the person that's going on behind whatever scene is going on. And so sometimes I even like to play the game, like, what if we never get to get off this train? What if this retreat never ends? What if I'm never rid of my fear? How does the journey go? And so it starts to be not just, not that kind of determination that we know how to do, but something else has to come. Because when we try to do it, we get tired. We have nervous breakdowns. And so feeling, maybe our language now would be feeling for what is sustainable. How to be in this train car, with or without tea, with loud people, with nice people, with nobody. Is that good? Is there something going on that I don't know about? Is there a riot? Sometimes there's been a riot. What's sustainable in this train car? Even if we would imagine we could never get off. So sometimes we need to know that it's going to end, that rage or terror or whatever. And that is the way through. And other times it can help to find a gentleness with what's going on. If we imagine that it could go on forever, which helps us realize how little control we have, it could go on forever. Forever meaning till I die. Is there any question?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So these things, how does one then discern which, with regard to work, or life's work, or whatever is presented in front of you, how then, when do you get gentle, and when do you cross it off of your being?
Mm-hmm.
So, because couldn't you approach with gentleness
mm-hmm.
all of those things, which, how do you know which is
mm-hmm.
your, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I think that approaching it with gentleness and having the pen in your hand kind of thing. So not like construing, not imagining gentleness to be something that doesn't have a pen in its hand. Not imagining gentleness to never say, I need you to be quiet in whatever words.
As you said yesterday, in the smaller group, that sometimes you can be a secret agent, and sometimes you need to leave the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that feeling, the secret agent feeling, pretty well. And if it's so, again, it's that.
Yeah.
What is the?
Yeah. So maybe not deciding the way we usually decide. And not imagining that we could decide the way we usually decide. But also then, if that's crossed off my list, deciding is crossed off my list, then there's more room for your own experience where sometimes either the circumstances made it clear that you couldn't do that and you could do this, and that's what happened. And other times you did have a feeling, knowing, of joy in being called, let's say. And you did or you didn't follow through, but it was clear. And then it's also, with gentleness, much easier to feel how uncomfortable the exhaustion mode is, like where I have to keep doing. How, not that it's wrong and that I shouldn't, but that it doesn't fit. And then accepting that that's a kind of, which is only in gentleness that that's possible. And accepting that that is a kind of knowing. And it's not really a decision, it's just a knowing. And then what I have found is having really one friend who is someone that I teach with, and also my teacher named Ajay, to be around and often enough to say, why don't you take the nap first and then do what's on your list. So even if it's a 20-minute nap instead of the 3 hours that I need, the 20 minutes is enough that when I get up, I look at my list really differently. And I see, for example, that it's 50 degrees Celsius, so whatever, 115 degrees outside. Maybe it's not the afternoon to go on the 45-minute smoky ride to town to see if the post office is going to end up being closed. So, and it's not always that obvious of a thing, but it does often enough happen that we stick to the list, and then the post office is closed that day. Or we just miss the person, and then we have, it like multiplies the things to do. Whereas if I go with, no, today it feels like in this book, the possibility of if I do it with distaste, I better not do it. And so today feels like what I'm getting is rest, even though I do need to do these things. And then you find out later that if you'd gone, it would have been closed at the post office. And when it fits in to do, it fits in often, like many things dovetailing together. Not just for my list. That's the other thing about the list. Is even if in my list is about helping other people, it's really my list. And when I go with the new list, it's not always fewer things on the new list, but usually. I have much more space to do something extra and fun, like, okay, so look, there's fresh bread. I don't need bread. I don't even eat bread, but I'm going to buy some. And look, bread. You need bread? Okay, here's your bread. And it does, as you're bringing this out, it's great. It does leave room for the things that should be on the list. The really deep, scary, and also simple things, like that phone call that we put off for 3 years or whatever.
There's a little extra question.
Great.
But I think, I mean, it's personal, but I'm sure many people can relate. So this, that fluidity of approach, and I've experienced that, certainly that dovetailing things just happen. I also see this in me, like a chronic distaste, approaching everything with distaste,
yeah.
Or chronic malcontent.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be, you know, stuffing my face with figs and honey and Crete and being, you know, like, eh. You know, I don't know if it's like mm-hmm. Sicilian, like, it's all right. Like, it's all right. But it could could be better.
Yeah.
And so that's when I hear what you're saying, that rises up as connected in some way, because we can approach every day, wake up in the dawn.
Yeah.
And then there are these sort of like things that drag us back under.
Yeah.
It's like I'm finding myself meeting the most delightful thing with work that I love.
Yeah.
Or I love. This is what I love to do, right? Eat the figs. But.
Yeah.
I'm.
Yeah. So two things, and that's exactly the day, the issue of daytime. And that's why I think it's really hard to get into the wisdom of day. So I just hope I can remember both of the things and say them one by one. Maybe the short one first. Sometimes it's like what we talked about hope and fear the first night, where it's good that I no longer think if I can just get the figs and honey thing to happen, then I'll be able to experience the joy that I'm craving. And so I could be open to joy for no reason instead of trying to get my fix. Like a joy that seems to come out of nothing. And also, it has to be said as well, like a joy that doesn't even taste like joy. So it happens when we go with joy often enough as a kind of practice, and we let it take over, then there starts to be another experience that maybe I would say is more like lightness, but it's not so easy to feel. It would be like the next room that we fumble into. And again, it seems to be like really nothing. But if I don't judge it by my idea of it as nothing, and I just wait, it's a kind of lightness and lifting up that's even hard to feel. It's not like the buoyancy that we would know and talk about. And so it's hard to even know, like there's not much reference point that it's there. And it's more like there's nothing else that calls me to do. But there isn't the distaste and the boredom in relation to that experience. It could be in relation to my idea of it. So then the second kind of point is totally related also. If I'm coming from the place of lack and living through my ideas of what is going on instead of what's actually going on, which is what we do. That's what we do. It is like that food that doesn't feed. I don't think it even gets half. And so it's confusing, because if the idea of food is present and the idea of eating is present and the experience is not satisfied, then we would tend to blame somebody. And depends on your stuff, like your psychological style, if it's yourself or somebody else. Rather than taking your experience into account and letting the experience, again, like if there's heaviness and I feel it, it doesn't seem so heavy. It doesn't seem to be heavy. If there's the dissatisfaction and I feel it, it's it's like the only way from there is like falling into peace. And then what is that can bring out the goodness that could be hidden in the experience of distaste or resentment, which is not demanding, just peace, not demanding. And I think that there's a really important point in here with regard to how we are in our in and about our whole spiritual practice. Or if you think of it more as like a self-improvement way or whatever. I think there's very, very usually that lack as the starting point. And so there's somewhere that wants to hurry to get it over with. And any sign of not progress or not being there already is really bothers us. And it bothers so much that it would easily make us quit the whole thing. Or what maybe is more likely is that we would take an easy way out, like an easy truth that's not really true. Like, so for example, I'll take this technique to save me, and I'll just put everything into that technique. And that's what makes us tired. I think what makes us tired is the thinking that I'm not good enough yet because my experience doesn't match. And then we look around and it's easy to feel like, well, nobody has it yet, so what's the point? But then there is that thing in us that isn't giving up, even when we do. The feeble, the weakest, that has the strongest and most determined. Because it has a light touch. So in the daytime, that means that we're allowed to enjoy doing the simple step-by-step. And to really remember that if it would be about getting there, it wouldn't be a path worth walking. And when it is just allowed to enjoy whatever this step is and whatever this step is. We would love to keep walking. And that gives a freedom and a liberating, transformative quality to the step that it doesn't have when I hate the step. Okay. So dusk. I love how in India, and I don't know much about other cultures, but probably in other cultures, how dusk and dawn are considered to be times of magic and sacredness. It's considered to be a time that it's the kind of border between the visible and the invisible is easy, transparent and loose, misty. And so one thing that could bring about is a willingness to be in that in between, to be at that edge. Where it's almost like being defined by being undefined. Taking on a definition of being undefined. And so this could bring us into touch with a kind of power that some traditional healers know well and can talk about. So where they often would and still sometimes do actually live at the edge of their community, literally. So between the organized and settled and the wild, the unsettled. And the wasteland. And I love this kind of, that maybe sort of inside humor that can happen there, where someone who lives at the edge and is known to be a healer is glad and even encourages the people who live in the settled town to be fearful of the shaman, so that the person who lives the settled life only comes when I really need help. And this can be true about community, but also feel how it can apply inside. So for example, we can leave a lot of room for the boring, repetitive, demanding thinking. And there's that sacred place that only gets approached when we're in touch with a need and we know it. We're willing to be humble enough and still feel our dignity to go to that place that's on the edge, that's undefined. And then there's the second part of this inside humor. I mean, I find it to be humorous. Where the shamans apparently say that they're not just glad to just not be bothered by someone stubbed their toe or is having troublesome thoughts or whatever, boring thoughts. But they're happy to be freed to do what's really needed and not the other stuff, because they have all this other work to do with the invisible world, or the invisible part of our world, and the ways that they can mediate, and, or let's just say in a more direct transmission, like they can feel a wider harmony and the potential for that wider harmony, including the settled and the wild and the visible and the invisible. And they can feel how one person's illness is part of that, is one symptom of that bigger picture. And how there might be lots of ways that a person who is with free time, undefined, so open, and tuned in, can help adjustments happen, can help what's been neglected be invited back in. And so what that partly means in our practice is that there's a way that it might be good to be clear about what I'm practicing, so that I'm not the whole time trying to decide with my brain, with my thinking, what shall I do? Wait, that's not quite right. It has to be perfect. So let's see. No, now I'll do the no, wait, the out-breath was good. Wait, the back of the body was better. Oh, that didn't work now. Oh, gosh. There's a way that just to keep it simple for us can help. But there's also a way that it's still simple to just know that we are practicing things that we don't know we're practicing. And that's also good. If we would, in our current condition, think that we're practicing them, we wouldn't be practicing them. We would be getting all in the way. And so dusk, also as a time of ending. It's a time that it can be easier to appreciate what comes off another person without their knowing it. So what they're kind of practicing that they don't realize they're practicing. And to enjoy that, whether we like the person or not. So that helps. That perspective can help the train ride. Have rejoicing in it. Rejoicing in each other's tender flavors. And of course, at the end of the day, it can be easier to feel what were the moments of joy, even if I had a horrible day. What were the moments of simple joy, even if I had a really high day? And especially, just from time to time, although I have a friend that this is one of his main practices, seeing you now as if you are you at the end of your life. So my friend talks about talking to the old man, even if he may not grow older than he is now, who knows, but he calls it talking to the old man. And the old man can lovingly say things straight about your list, about what's not on your list, about what's still on your list. And can also say about patience, gentleness, not knowing that the decision was not the important part. And that even if you screwed up your list, that's also not really that important. And what was important? There was a teacher named Aurobindo, who was also a freedom fighter in India. And while he was in jail, this seems to be quite a common thing that happens, is while you're in jail, you write your best from St. John of the Cross to Aurobindo and many others in between and before and after. He writes about different layers of us, and one that interests us, especially on a meditation retreat, is he calls soul. And I used to never use that word because it has so many different meanings, and especially it has so many charges on it for people often. But I like what he says about soul. He talks about us as being physical and also being what he calls vital. So there's the day energy, and there's sexual energy, and there's wanting to eat energy, etc. And there's mental, the mental body. And then there are two other layers, and one is the soul. It's not the last layer. But it's such a deep layer. It's so much like our inmost experience of this life that some people never even once consciously experience it in their whole life. And so a moment that we could be a little bit in touch with that inmost place that Aurobindo calls soul, even once. He talks about, just to give you more of a flavor of what he means by that inmost place, he experience that there are past lives that come into and include this life. We can take that metaphorically or realistically, whatever, but I find it as a nice metaphor or description of his experience. That looking back on past lives and feeling the moments where the soul kind of could peek through, could be seen, could be in touch, that's all that we would remember. Those are the only moments in his experience, in Aurobindo's experience, that we could remember now, out of all of those times of eating and playing and having sex and climbing mountains and dying and whatever. But only the moments in any of those experiences where we were really there. We weren't hiding that secret, vulnerable, powerful place from ourselves or from what seems to be the outside world. Those are the moments where there's some kind of growth, some kind of learning that stays with us. And so in the dusk mind, it's maybe easier to be willing to let your soul show. Or with that perspective of this whole life that in some way has been given, whether we like it or not. And the possibility that there is something in us that we could kind of let out and let in. So the night, I'm giving such long talks these days, it's weird. I thought this was going to be like 20, 30 minutes and then we would either be silent or talk together. So let's do night tomorrow.
Tomorrow, what
do
we miss tomorrow?
No, I don't know. So it's good that this will be my topic tomorrow, or the beginning of it, which until this moment was an unknown. May we be peace. In this life and out of it. May our gathering together and our willingness just to be here be part of a momentum towards liberation and peace everywhere.